Hello and welcome to Ask Jumper Newsstand with Amanda Chin
and Adeline Huang.
And we're gonna be discussing Adeline's choice of film today.
Yes, and I'm so very, very excited. First of all, because this is the beginning of December. It is my favorite month, okay? To all the winter babies out there, I love you guys. But also because...
all the saggies.
Also because... this movie that we're talking about in this episode today is my all-time favorite movie ever. And last week, we mentioned that December's theme is going to be movies that have snow or basically winter scenes in it because we hate watching Christmas Hallmark movies. So we settled for like just movies with winter.
It's kind of hypocritical of us too, but we're also reviewing some new Christmas films that are coming out.
Well, yeah, but you know, we're reviewing it doesn't mean, you know, it's a thing that we genuinely enjoy. I don't know. I just really do not like, you know, Christmas themed movies ever.
I enjoy it if there's lesbians in it.
Okay, that makes sense. But like, how many Christmas movies out there have lesbians?
One.
Two? Two. Exactly. There's not a lot. But anyway,
let's so we were supposed to record Happy Feet today, but because Adeline wanted me to watch both Happy Feet 1 and 2.
Because you can't talk about just one Happy
Feet.
And then
I was like, okay, and then, but that's a lot. That's like 3 hours, man. And then Adeline's like, you know what? Then watch The Grandmaster instead. But then, you know what? It turns out it took me 6 hours to finish The Grandmaster.
I was with her, like, the last hour of the movie. And dead ass, every 2 seconds, she would pause the movie and check her phone. Like, she keeps on telling me that she appreciates the movie. And I really do think she does appreciate it.
I do appreciate it, but it's so hard to watch it.
Well, because Wong Kar-wai just isn't for everyone. I mean, we're going to get into that later, but I have to admit, this movie is pretty slow-paced.
But I do love Wong Kar-wai's aesthetic, though. Like, gotta admit.
Visually pleasing.
Yeah.
This is an immaculate movie.
It's just hard for me to sit still, especially with, like, ADHD.
Yeah, I get that. I get that. I get why. And this is, like, a 2-hour and 10-minute movie.
Yeah, but I mean, if I'm not hooked from the start about the film... I don't think I would be able to sit still. Because, like, a lot of films that I have rented and spent money on, I did the same thing. And then they give me, like, two days to finish a film. And then I just don't touch it anymore. But, yeah, we're going to start off with the summary of the film.
We haven't even mentioned the title yet. But, yeah, we're going to get into the film. And this episode, we're gonna be talking about Wong Kar-wai's The Grandmaster. And this is a synopsis, just a short plot about the movie taken from Google.
Cool.
So the movie is about the peaceful life of Ip Man, a martial artist whose life is being threatened when he is chosen by the Southern Masters to represent them so he can take on Gong Yutian, a martial arts grandmaster from the northern side of China. I know it sounds simple, but there's just so much to the movie than, you know, two grandmasters fighting it out.
Yeah, I low-key was expecting that, and, like, I didn't get what
I expected. She just didn't get it.
I mean, I get the film, I get it, like, the whole gist of it, but what I didn't really get was, like, I thought at first it was just gonna be, like, this feud between the North and the South.
It's really not.
But nope. All I can say, it's basically a mashup of everything, kind of.
I guess you could say that, yeah, I can see why you're saying that.
But also, I feel like... the movie is very anticlimactic in a lot of ways. Because, like, you know how in a lot of, like, action movies, it's usually, like, it flows literally, like, in the middle. And then it goes, like, peaks. Mm-hmm. And it just, like, de-escalates. And it's, like, done. But, like, not with this film. Because it's Wong Kar-wai.
It is Wong Kar-wai.
Like, Wong Kar-wai just don't work like that.
Yeah,
he just doesn't work like that.
But anyway... as always, we're going to have 3 segments that we're going to be discussing about the movie. First, we're going to go with look, Second, plot and characters. And then third, we're going to discuss the ending and conclusion of the whole story. But before we go on into our first segment, I want to reiterate how this is my all-time favorite movie. Literally nothing I've watched ever since has beaten The Grandmaster. And I know for a fact that I'm not biased. I think I've mentioned once or twice in this podcast about how I'm a big fan of Wong Kar-wai. Mm-hmm. He's my favorite director. But The Grandmaster was my very first Wong movie. So I didn't know anything about Wong Kar-wai mm-hmm. before I watched The Grandmaster with okay. my dad in the theaters. So I'm definitely not biased. This is the movie that got me hooked to Wong Kar-wai.
I would say that the film that actually got me wanting to watch Wong Kar-wai movies is actually In the Mood for Love.
I can get why, because that is like one of his greatest movies
ever.
Yeah,
and I feel like it fits more with my aesthetic. Mm, you know, like,
it's because it's very art
house. What I find is visually pleasing. Before we get into the segment again, I kind of want to like talk a bit about the different versions
yes.
of the film.
It's really interesting, right? Because
like from Adeline, she told me that there's the 108 minutes, which is from the Weinstein Company from the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
when they distribute it, and then there's from the Berlin International Film Festival, and it's like 128 minutes. I think.
128 or 123?
Yeah, and then mm-hmm. the original like Chinese/Cantonese version
mm-hmm.
is 130 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're discussing.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about
the full length.
Yeah, the Chinese uncut version.
So and basically the director's mm-hmm. cut.
You know, Wong is so notorious for making and releasing different cuts of his movies. The Grandmaster wasn't actually like the first movie that he released various cuts of. He did the same with Chungking Express, did the same
mm-hmm.
with Ashes of Time.
Yeah, like that's... We're just going to tell you guys which exact version
mm-hmm.
we're discussing today.
Also because, like, the Weinstein cut was so butchered, so we're just going to talk about the true, you know, true vision Wong Kar-wai had for The Grandmaster.
So, before we start, we'd like to put a disclaimer that we're not professional filmmakers, and we're not film students, we're film lovers who happen to make films. And also, be warned, because spoilers from this point on.
Mm-hmm. Spoilers ahead.
So let's get into segment one, the look and visual aesthetic.
Stunning. Absolutely stunning. I love pretty movies. And this is it. Because this is a martial arts movie. And I don't know, it's just martial arts movies always have a certain aesthetic to it. You kind of know what to expect when you're watching another Chinese
mm-hmm.
martial arts movie. But Wong Kar-wai, just, oh God, he raised all of that. He literally created a Wong Kar-wai martial arts movie. And martial arts isn't something that Wong Kar-wai dives deep into at all.
Oh yeah, and I can totally see that. Like at first I was coming in expecting kung fu and just fighting, like
mm-hmm.
endless fighting throughout the whole film, but that wasn't what I got. Like,
it's not.
And in the end, like, the underlying themes are still love and like family and all that stuff, you know, that the themes that Wong Kar-wai
mm-hmm.
usually dabbles with in his other films
mm-hmm.
too, especially with Happy Together and like
Definitely.
In the Mood for Love.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I would also like to highlight that wait, I forgot what I was about to say.
You lost your train
of
thought.
I lost.
There's really a lot to unpack with The Grandmaster specifically. Because...
Oh, yeah. I would like to say that I don't necessarily watch a lot of martial arts films. Because I'm not, like, really in that scene. But, like, Huang knows more about it.
I watch a lot of martial arts movies. Like, I dig that shit. You know, I'm my father's daughter. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. So, whatever he watch... I watch.
And like, I like the fact that one thing that you told me, we were kind of discussing it a bit before we got into the podcast, and you were talking about how it's different from like other martial
yes.
arts films and why it's different. But
yes.
I forgot what it's about. Okay.
Yeah.
You
so
talk more?
Let me get into it. Just, you know, look-wise specifically, a little background. On how Wong works with his movies is that he frequently works with the same people because I think it's just because he's comfortable with the same people.
For sure,
because yeah.
it usually works like that. Like a lot
mm-hmm.
of directors usually tend to work with the same cinematographers or same editors and same cast too, mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. They usually are aligned with their vision too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So with Wong Kar-wai and cinematography, he previously frequently works with Christopher Doyle. He's Australian, and Christopher Doyle's sort of like iconic look when it comes uh-huh. to cinematography is his extreme close-ups. So he creates this claustrophobic feel. You don't have a lot of wide shots. Everything's just really extreme close-up, extreme close-up.
And I think he also does a lot of like softness.
Yes. His look is always so soft. Now with Grandmaster, Wong decided not to work with Christopher Doyle. And I really respect that decision because to me, I think it wouldn't have worked with Doyle at all.
I think it's because like also Doyle has like a very specific style.
Yeah. I don't think it would have fit with Grandmaster at all.
I feel like it would totally be a different look if he mm-hmm. were to be the cinematographer. Because like with the cinematographer now, like the sword, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Phil Lesword.
I feel like since he's not that well known, maybe in a way he doesn't have a particular style yet.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe like, because the cinematography is beautiful, but it's I don't think it has anything that stands out as Christopher Doyle's cinematography.
Yes, that's the thing. Christopher Doyle has character. When you look at a Christopher Doyle movie, you know that Doyle worked on this. It's really apparent. But with Le Sword, I don't think he has that character yet because
What works, I guess, because like in a way, you want the visuals, like the scenes of the martial arts, like kung fu fighting, to be the one standing in out, not the cinematography.
Yes.
Because it's not about the emotions anymore. It is about the action.
Yes.
Which Wong Kar-wai wanted to focus on, mm-hmm. which is like what I'm thinking about the film.
Manda, like Manda mentioned before, Philip Lesort just doesn't have like a trademark to him yet. Maybe it's because he only has about 7 or 8 movies under his belt. He just hasn't developed it maybe, or because he just doesn't wanna. I'm not really familiar with like Lesort's other work, apart from The Grandmaster. But Manda mentioned before when we were discussing that she thinks the cinematography is meh. I mean, it's nice, but there's nothing unique to it. I beg to differ. I think I need to give like a lot of kudos to Philip Lesword for his success in The Grandmaster, because he succeeds in martial art cinematography where other cinematographers failed. He was able to basically show emotion that is more than just anger and determination within a battle. Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Mm-hmm. I was just looking at his filmography, and he actually did a recent.
He did film. A 2020 film, but yeah, I haven't
it's
watched
called
it.
Called Under Rocks, mm-hmm. and it's Sofia Coppola. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
but I don't know. Like Sofia Coppola is not really my. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't really necessarily watch a lot of her films. But yeah, I get what you mean.
But anyway, it's like,
that's like the side that I'm not really familiar with, I guess. Especially with like what you're saying about martial arts films.
So with martial arts films, or really any action film, when you pay attention to the fight scenes, it's like the only emotion you see is either anger, like I said, or determination, or just these two people trying so hard to come out victorious from this fight. So mm-hmm. the scenes are always, they're usually like, they have a lot of wide shots, and it's always recorded in like 60 FPS, so everything just moves really, really fast, you know? But with Le Sword, it has a lot of slow motions. It has a lot of like extreme close-ups. So there's so much more emotion to the fight scenes compared to any other movie. And I think that's where Le Sword, like, succeeds.
Yeah, but also I think it's because a lot of it is also because it's also Wong Kar-wai's decision to do these small scenes, the close-ups. Because,
mm-hmm.
like, definitely, like, they both work together in deciding which shots are shot and, like, all that. You get what I'm saying? So it's like, I think they work pretty, like, they work pretty good together for the Grandmaster.
For the Grandmaster, but I don't think Wong would, you know, work with Lesword again for any other movie.
Yeah, I don't think so either, because, like, I feel like he's found his niche in Christopher Doyle.
He did, yeah.
Especially with a lot of his films that thematically are about love and drama.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of, you know, fight scenes, again, immaculate, but it isn't just thanks to Lesword's hard work, but of course also to the martial arts choreographer, Yuan Wuping. Yuan Wuping has a very, very extensive portfolio under his belt. He worked in Kill Bill, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, The Matrix. So he's a very, very talented martial arts choreographer. And
you can totally see it, though. Like, I feel like the kung fu scenes are very, very complicated.
Yes. And why do I think that Yuan Wuping did a very good job in The Grandmaster? I mean, we know that he's talented. But he did a particularly good job in this one. Because he isn't just tasked with having to create, like, pretty choreography or cool kicks and good-looking punches. He's tasked with creating choreography that blended together different forms of martial arts, because that was the central theme of the Grandmaster, bringing the northern and southern styles together.
And also I think a lot of part of it is, like, fighting is usually seen as, like, something vicious and aggressive, and it's always, like, and it's always, like, okay, like, we're fighting here, like, Avengers style. Like, we're gonna wreck this building. Like, punch it. Like, you know, wreck this shit. Whatever. And it's always so brutal, and it's always so aggressive. And it's, like, wrecking everything around you.
Yes.
What surprised me the most was, like, how much the kung fu that they're fighting or the battles that they're fighting are indoors and not, like, in rinks or in open space.
Yes.
And they are literally not wrecking anything in the room. Like, it's very slow and subtle and silent, but at the same time, deadly.
Yes. Yes, this is where Yuan Wuping did such a good job. Because it isn't just about what kick looks good. What if we throw this person around and it'll look cool or whatever.
But also kudos to the actors, though.
Yes, of course. Because
the actors executed it, like, really, really well.
Here's a fun fact. Tony Leung, the actor... He broke his arm, yes. But Tony Leung, the actor that played Ip Man in the movie, he doesn't know how to do martial arts at all. You compare him with Donnie Yen. Donnie Yen is another actor who frequently plays the role of Ip Man in, like, you know, the more blockbuster version of Ip Man instead of Wong Kar-wai's story. It's like, Donnie Yen knows kung fu. He knows martial arts. Tony Leung does not. Zhang Ziyi, the girl who played Gong Er, she also doesn't know kung fu.
Well, that's the thing, though. It's choreography.
Choreography was amazing. Lesword did a good job.
Because I feel like, in the end, even though it's a fight scene, it's always still a dance.
It is. It's performance.
It's about the dance between two collaborators and not, like, one person just, like, hitting someone, like, trying to hit someone. Because martial arts.
Woo-hoo-hoo! But you also need to give credit to Lesword for this, because it was him who made it seem as if Tony Leung was this badass martial arts grandmaster, even though he's not. So he did a really good job with that. Anyway, I think
even though there's still so much to say about the visual aesthetic, I think we gotta move on to the plot.
I have one last thing to say. We also need to give credit to William Chang Suk-ping. He was the art director for this movie. And if you notice, he did such a wonderful job with the costume, with the set design. It was amazing. Such a pity that Wong Kar-wai doesn't work with a lot of wide shots. There's a lot of extreme close-ups, right? Pity that we didn't get more wide shots that enabled the audience to see the set design, like, properly, you know?
I think a wide shot is not necessary, though, because, like, a lot of it are, like, a lot of what Wong Kar-wai works with are, like, emotions, and trying to portray the emotions really well. And I think that is where a wide shot would kind of ruin the moment.
Ah, yeah.
It would ruin the atmosphere that he has created. Like, imagine two people looking at each other in a Wong Kar Wai style shot, and then suddenly they cut to a wide angle. Mm-hmm. Like, that would kind of cut the tension.
Mm. Can I also say, the costume department, they were also amazing. If you pay attention to the scenes in the Golden Pavilion, where you have, like, these girls, you know, in a lot of these shots, every single one of them had her own unique cheongsam. So he put a lot of thought into that. Fun fact, both Le Sword and William Chang Suk-ping got nominations for Best Cinematography and Best Costume Design in the 86 Academy Awards, but they did not win. Just nominated. And I'm hurt. But let's move on to plot and characters.
Non-white, like, films. Shade.
Anyway, plot and characters.
Plot and characters. Should I talk first? Plot and characters. I think you should start.
What I love the most about, like, the plot, why do I love The Grandmaster compared to other martial arts movies? Do you know how many directors out there have tried to create a movie from Ip Man's life? It's so glorified. It's like so overused. It's such an overused plot at this point. And I was, you know, I'm kind of surprised after knowing Wong Kar-wai's history with filmmaking that he decided to, you know, pick up the whole Ip Man story again. But where does Grandmaster differ from the other Ip Man movies? It's where in other Ip Man movies, he's always portrayed as the hero. When he fights, he's just trying to take down this big, bad guy, trying to save his family or save his disciples or save a school or whatever. But in The Grandmaster, Ip Man isn't a hero at all. He meets a tragic end, technically. He's just a human trying to live his life. And that's what I love so much about the plot.
I think, like, in my opinion, he is still the hero within the film, but it also kind of gives you a different perspective of the life of Ip Man, I guess.
It's by no means an autobiography or whatever. Oh, yeah, like, but a lot of this is, like, a dramatization.
Yeah, but mm-hmm. Like, I mean, it is based on true story, that's one. And two, a lot of, like, other Ip Man movies are, like, focusing on the fight scenes and not really focusing on, like, the humanistic aspect of a person's life, which is, I think, what Wong Kar-wai kind of wants to portray more within the films, I mean, this film.
This is also an aspect where I think Wong is a very talented filmmaker. It's because with martial arts movies, every single time, do you realize that the action scenes are put there as part of the aesthetic? It doesn't necessarily move the story forward. A lot of the fight scenes are put in there just because, oh yeah, it's pretty. But because, like, it's like, okay, how do I explain this? Say, let's take The Avengers. It's an action movie.
What do you mean? Like, you mean in usual other, like, other films or just?
Yeah, just other like action or martial arts movies. Let's take The Avenger. Yeah, the whole idea is just built on, like, how the Avengers have to fight these bad guys, and then there's gonna be, like, there's a formula.
You know,
there's gonna be, like,
about
a final battle in which they're gonna win in the end,
yeah,
or something
like,
right?
Really like that. Because that was what I was more expecting when I first got into it.
The Grandmaster doesn't have
and
that.
And then I kind of, like, went 6 hours trying to watch it and not finishing it. But yeah, like, I feel like this film is kind of like Martin Scorsese's The Irishman.
I love The Irishman.
It was great. It has the same vibe when you think about it.
It probably does, because it's very slow-paced. It's a slow build.
Let me tell you a fun fact. I did walk out of The Irishman from the theater.
That was such a shame, Amanda. The Irishman is really good.
I cannot sit still.
Let's compare. Let's compare The Irishman and The Grandmaster. In The Irishman, every time the main character kills someone off, it propels the story forward. It doesn't just move the story forward. Do you understand what I'm saying? It propels it. There's so much emotion behind it. So much planning that goes before an action is even taken. And it's the same with The Grandmaster. Every fight scene propels the story forward. It evolves the story. So the fight scene is as equally important to the story.
But I feel like I would prefer the Grandmaster compared to Irishman.
Thank you for saying that.
Just because.
Oh my god.
Just because I love Wong Kar-wai's aesthetic. Like, I love his visuals.
Visually pleasing.
Like, I love the way he lights, like, his shots.
He's so talented.
Like, compared to, like, Martin Scorsese. Not saying that Martin Scorsese is a bad director.
He's
because,
amazing.
Because I love his other films. Like, yeah. I love the Wolf of Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I love, like, Shutter Island. Mm-hmm. I think that's Martin Scorsese, if I'm not mistaken. But, like, yeah, I love his other films. I just don't particularly love The Irishman.
Mm.
But I feel like I love The Grandmaster more because than The Irishman because I love the visuals better. Like, it works with it works better, and I know, like, I know this because I've seen Wong Kar-wai's other films, and they're all very consistent, like, with delivering the visuals.
It's very Wong-esque. Every single Wong Kar-wai movie shows that it's a product of Wong Kar-wai, one way or another. But I feel like, since we're in the plot segment, in order for us to be able to understand the plot, we need to understand the characters. So I think I want to talk a little bit of, like, the three main characters. We have Gong-er, Ma-san, and Ip Man himself.
Wait, Ma-san's the main character?
He is! Because he drives the story forward much more than Gong-er's dad or the Razor. Or do you want to talk about five of them, if we have time?
I mean, we could start with Tony's character.
We'll start with Ip Man, yeah. What do you think of him?
I don't know. Like, I think you should talk first. Because I just finished the film, and, like, I feel like I need you to talk to kind of get me talking about, oh, like, oh,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
true. That's
Manda awesome. Just finished the film. I've watched this movie.
After six hours.
Yeah, after 6 hours. I have watched this movie about 10 times. I've basically memorized the lines already, but let's not get into that. Anyway, to me, Ip Man's character here is the most distant one. Because the only time he shows what he's thinking, or even when he shows, like, a sliver of emotion, it's always subtle and fleeting. Which I think reflects a lot into the martial arts style that he studied. So Ip Man is a grand master of Wing Chun. And from what I read, you know, the very little knowledge I have of martial arts, Wing Chun is a very compact form of martial arts. It's a lot more defensive. It doesn't have flashy movements. Doesn't even have, like, these fancy ass... It's not fancy at all. It's not supposed to look pretty on screen. Doesn't look strong. It's a very defensive, like, martial arts.
Which I think is pretty cool, because when you think of Kung Fu, you're always thinking of, like, the crouching tiger.
Yeah, or, yeah, like, some shit like, you
or, like,
know.
Some shit of, like...
Someone flying off a roof.
Or, like, honestly, like, I forgot who that dude's name is, the one in the Kung Fu Hustle.
Stephen Chow.
Like, yeah. Those
him,
kinds
like,
of
yeah,
Kung
yeah, that
Fu.
Kind of shit, like, flying into the air and all that. Wing Chun doesn't have that.
Which we don't really get a lot in, like, Ip Man's moves in this film, by the way. Like, his moves are very, like Huang said, like, it's very compact.
Yeah.
It's very straightforward. And I think I do get, like, the defensive part of it. Like, he's just, like, kind of using his opponent's
momentum yeah.
to kind of propel them and attack them
yeah.
in that way.
Yeah,
like,
it's very, like...
He's, like, waiting for the right moment to attack.
Which is why it isn't flashy. And like I said...
But it works.
Like, yeah. It's very defensive. And... It really reflects that to Ip Man's character.
Yeah,
because
like, I feel like
he is defensive. He keeps his emotions hidden.
And I feel like in order to do that, you need to be able to have enough patience, you know, especially in a fight. Because in usual fights, it's like people are just really mad and they're very aggressive. They're like, okay, let me hit this person. Let's go.
He doesn't
you know?
Show that.
But he's
Ip
not
Man
like
does
that.
Not.
He's like waiting for the right time, the right moment to attack.
Mm-hmm. Can I just say, though, that Ip Man, even though being the most, like, technically emotionally constipated out of all the other characters out there, his progress, like, his character progress, I feel like is the one that's most apparent in the movie. because in the very beginning you see him, even though he doesn't show a lot of emotion on his face, you see him as this very cocky guy who's all like, oh, I gotta be humble, but at the same time I know that I could probably kick your ass, into this really broken shell of a man after he starts losing every single thing he holds dear. And that's where it's like, there's just so much to unpack in this movie, so much to unpack about Ip Man's story. He isn't just a grandmaster. He's a father. He's a husband. He's also a man. There's so much to his struggle that we could unpack, but it would take like 7 hours.
But then, like, I could also say that, like, which is what Wong Kar Wai wanted to deliver with the film. Because, yes, like, with
Tony Leung.
No, Donnie Yen.
Oh, Donnie Yen, yeah. Donnie Yen's Ip Man.
It's like when you say it's like blockbuster kind of thing. Yeah. It's more like focusing on his fights and mm-hmm. his battles. Mm-hmm. But this one's like a more sympathetic and empathetic approach to mm-hmm. Ip Man as a person, mm-hmm. as a human being, with emotions, with his own problems, and not just the fighting scenes, which are not prominent and not like standing out like a sore thumb in this film. Yeah.
Do you want to talk about Ip Man and Gong Er's relationship?
I actually didn't notice the relationship until you brought it up. Like, I thought that Gong Er had a crush on Ip Man, but then not necessarily Ip Man on her.
Like, reciprocating her feelings.
Yeah. Because, like you said, maybe it's because, like, Tony's character, like, Ip Man in this film is
emotionally constipated.
Like, very defensive and very, like, cut off from, like, his emotions. He's like, okay, emotions are shit. Let's not face them. I'm just going to face whatever it is with my kung fu.
But that's also something that is really important. It's a very important aspect. Gong Er and Ip Man's relationship in this movie. I think that there are two very important relationships to the movie. Gong Er and her dad. Gong Er and Ip Man. Now, with Gong Er and Ip Man, like you said, I mean, from the very beginning, it was really clear that Gong Er, like, had a thing for Ip Man. But I feel like, I don't know. See, this is something that I'm really torn on, because I have watched the movie again and again, and I'm trying to come up with a conclusion, and I just can't. Because I cannot, for the life of me, figure out whether Ip Man was actually in, like, actually had feelings for Gong Er, or was he just really interested about, like, the 64 hands? Because Gong Er and Ip Man's character, to me, are parallels in the story. It's always mentioned that these two people, are like obsessed with kung fu, obsessed with martial arts. It's even like explicitly mentioned in the movie how Gong Er, towards the end of her life, people mentions how she's like really obsessed with kung fu. Is that the same thing for Ip Man?
I actually see it more mm-hmm. like, I think the 64 hands are just like kung fu flirting.
In a way, I guess. But I think I want to say that what
it's
you're
kind
trying
of like how I'm attracted to a lot of academia femmes and calling them nerds.
I guess. What?
Because okay. You can see it that way.
I feel like it's a lot deeper like than that.
It's like a metaphorical way of I fucking.
The words, no! The words 64 hands in the movie, I feel like serves as a metaphor for so many things. To Ip Man, the 64 hands is what he could have with Gong Er. To Gong Er, the 64 hands is a life that she covets. It's like a past that she constantly wants to stay in.
But what is 64 hands, literally?
Literally 64 hands. It's basically like a set of movements that becomes like the ultimate move in like the martial arts, you know?
It's like jurus.
Yeah. Some shit like crouching tiger, hidden dragon. That's like...
I'm sorry, I kind of hit the mic
specific, yeah, that's like a specific set of moves within, like, the martial arts that Gong Er practices, which is Bagua.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I like the fact that they, like, brought it up over and over again, kind of like a thematic kind of thing.
Yeah, because it also has a relation to the whole, like, Gong legacy that Gong Er was so set on like retrieving from Ma-san. Because like the 64 hands was the one thing, technically the only thing that Gonger's dad passed down to her.
Mm-hmm.
It was only passed down to Gonger. It's that important. No one else in the world.
Yeah, not even Ma-san.
Not even Ma-san. No one else in the world knows how to use the 64 hands technique. Only Gonger and her dad. And her dad's dead. So Gonger's the last person who knows
how
to do it.
Which kind of proves also, like, especially within the Chinese community, about, I guess, the taboo-ness or, like, the acceptance of into a family is really hard. Especially if you're adopted.
Now that you mention it, let's move on to Ma-san.
Because, like, with Ma-san's story arc, it's all about him trying to fulfill being part of a Gong family.
I'm right? so glad that you I'm so glad that you realized that. Well, go on.
But, like, when you think about it, like, it's such a taboo thing, especially within the Chinese and Indonesian mm-hmm. community, or the Chinese community in general, if you adopt a child, and then they're, like, and then people would be gossiping about it. People would be like, oh, did you know she's adopted? Like, as if it's, like, a bad thing.
Yeah, but it's also the importance of, like, legacy and carrying on the family name, some shit
like
exactly.
that. Exactly, and how important it is in within the Chinese community and culture to bear children and pass on your offsprings and
yes.
have, like, more family, as in, like, continuing the family legacy in that way.
Ma-san, from the very beginning of his story until the very end of his arc, fights, I feel like the only driving aspect of his character is just trying to be considered a part of the Gong family.
Yeah, because you can see it definitely with him obeying his teacher, like, really from the start.
Because if you think about it, Gonger and Ma-san, they're technically brought up with the same values, you know what I mean? Technically, they have the same father. They live in the same goddamn house.
But
they're taught by the same teacher.
But the only difference they have is that Gong-er is, like, an official
official Gong offspring.
Yeah.
Ma-san isn't. So I feel like even from the very beginning, it's already shown how Ma-san is set up to never be an official part of the family.
Which made me empathize more with Ma-san's character.
He's a really great character. He's great. I really love his character.
Because despite them portraying him as, like,
the
a
villain,
traitor,
technically, yeah.
Well, technically he isn't, because he couldn't get the family aspect from the Gong family. That's why he's trying to, like, separate himself in a way from that to kind of, like,
to redeem himself. He's always trying
to redeem himself and also kind of, like, create his own path in life without the Gong family overshadowing that.
Because
all this time, he's always, like, the adopted child of the Gong family.
And I feel like he knows. He knows deep inside that he's just, you know...
Yeah, which is why he's, like, he's trying to get rid of that and make a path for himself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, trying to redeem himself and, like, in that way. Mm-hmm. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because, like, he knows that he can't, like, redeem himself in a way that is... not straying away from the Gong family, because that is never his path from the first place. Like, he's never set up for that. It's always Gong-er that is set up for that.
And I feel like it makes Gong-er and Ma-san's relationship so much more
complicated
and deeper than the audience could ever understand. But speaking of Gong-er, I love her character. She's really badass. But one more thing that I like about her character is her arc. It's her story, her struggle, the sorrow that she faces. She's such a well-thought-out character and addition to the whole plot of the Grandmaster. Because I think she has the most interesting story. She basically ties everything together. Her willingness to fight until the end for the Gong family legacy. Her
that determination also highlights a lot of what Chinese culture is. It's about preserving your family name, a lot of, like, saving face and having to, like, stick up for your family till the end.
That's Gong-er. That's basically Gong-er, like, 100%.
That's, like, the epitome of what Chinese culture is. Like, we talked about when we were talking about Saving Face and like All's Well Ends Well.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like she has such a tragic story to her life. Because if you think about it, Gong-er, like you said, is the epitome of what a perfect Chinese kid would be. She's smart, she's talented, she listens so well to her
dad.
She's
a doctor.
She's a doctor! Ooh.
Did we mention that?
She was also willing to go through like all these extra lengths to make sure that the Gong-er, that the Gong family honor is restored. She literally is the perfect Chinese child. The only flaw she has is that she's a woman.
Exactly. The downfall of a perfect Chinese kid
is that they're a woman.
Mm-hmm.
It was mentioned so many times by Ma San, by her family members.
When you think about it, if she was a guy, I feel like her dad wouldn't even bother with Ma San.
Yeah. Ma San wouldn't even be in the story if Gong-er was born as a boy. None of this like tension and bullshit would
Which
be happening.
Leads to her wanting to prove herself to her dad.
Ma San and Gong-er are basically two sides of the same coin.
Legit.
They're the same people.
The difference is that one's a real kid, the other's
the other's adopted.
Like, I mean, real as in like, you know, by blood. Like biologically.
Yeah.
Related. Not that I'm saying Ma San is not like, I mean, in a way, he is also treated as a kid, like, as, like, what's her dad's name?
Gong Yutian.
Gong Yutian's, like, kid, but treated kind of differently because he's not related by blood.
Mm.
He's not tied by blood.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's shitty about it. Like, she knows that he can't fully be committed as a Gong, like, family because he's not blood related.
I feel like, at the end of the day, the Gong family is just, like, a really fucked up family. Like, that's a family with a lot of issues, bro.
Dude, when you think about it, every Chinese family is fucked up.
They've got issues.
They're all about, like, yo, family, name, saving face. But then, like,
honor.
And then at the same time, like, fucking up their kid because of these values that they think is supposed to be the right thing when raising kids.
I feel like...
like, instilling this values.
Yeah, now that you mention about the whole, like, parent-child relationship, I feel like had Gong-er been raised differently by her dad, she would have had a more peaceful life. She would have been more at peace with, you know, the whirlwind that the universe keeps throwing at her.
And especially with Ma San, too. Like, if their dad didn't really focus much on, like, the idea of, like, blood-related, you know, all that shit.
And his,
like,
obsession with kung fu, basically.
Yeah, like, I feel like Ma San would be, like, easier everyone to be accepted
by the family. Everyone would just be really content. And let's talk a little bit about Gong Yutian.
So technically they both have daddy issues.
Yeah, they do. Let's talk about Gong Yutian. As great of a... the dad.
Oh, right.
As great of a grandmaster that he
is. He's a shitty dad.
He's...
gotta put it out there. He's a
shitty
dad.
He's a pretty shitty dad, even though it's not highlighted a lot because, you know, that's technically not a theme in the movie, but this is just us analyzing.
I think it's like an underlying theme that is not really... Well, when you think about it, a lot of films have underlying themes. Mm-hmm. Like you said, love and acceptance of
then
life.
The underlying
and stuff like
theme
that.
Is family.
Then this, like I said, like a lot of like Wong Kar-wai's films also dabbles with family.
Mm.
Especially also, like, in The Mood for Love.
Yes.
About, like, choosing either reciprocating your love for this other person or choosing to stay with your significant other when you know they're cheating on you.
It's just saving face yet again and trying to maintain
like
what you
that,
already have.
That same constant, analysis, I guess, from Wong Kar-wai in trying to, like, maybe... dig out his inner problems.
I guess. Okay.
Maybe he does have daddy issues.
But
just saying.
But another thing that I love about, you know, the plot and the characters is how Wong basically ties everyone together. Here's my analysis of the whole thing. how Gonger and Ip Man's relationship mirror Gonger's and her dad's relationship. You know how when you really look at it...
Wait, who's who and Ip Man's relationship?
Gonger and Gonger's dad. With,
okay.
Yeah, those two relationships. It's like, when you think about it, Gong Yutian was as much Kung Fu obsessed as Ip Man is.
Yeah.
The only way Gonger could relate to her father...
Oh my god, daddy issues.
Yeah, is through Kung Fu. So, yeah, in that last scene...
Dude, and I feel like... When you think about it, Gong Er is like, how old is she?
She was really young in that movie.
Right? And
yeah.
And Tony's character is like 40.
They're legal, by the way, guys. Guys, it's legal.
Yeah,
they're
legal. Yeah, but I mean like,
but daddy it was issues. A pretty big age gap. Daddy There's a pretty issues. Big age gap between them.
Daddy issues.
Well, yeah, but let's dive deeper into that a little bit.
Yeah, you now notice that you think, yeah. Now that you bring it up, like, yeah, like... It's kind of like that parallel, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, you're looking for something that you don't have. Like, you're kind of missing in life as you're growing up.
Yeah, a bit like that.
Kind of also like how your attachment issues as you were a kid or your childhood trauma kind of affect who you are in relationships when you're an adult.
Mm. Notice how nearing the end of the movie, before Gonger dies, she goes like, I choose to spend the rest of my life in the moments where I was happiest. And then it cuts to a scene where she's doing Kung Fu.
Oh.
That's literally the only way that she can, like, Gonger's arc is always, focuses on her dad, trying to, like, get revenge on her dad's death. So literally the only way she can connect to her dad is through Kung Fu.
Because that's what they're just obsessed with.
Yeah. I mean, it isn't Gonger's fault. So when Gonger has feelings for Ip Man, I just feel like that she finds something familiar in Ip Man. Because like I said, both Gong Yutian and Ip Man are Kung Fu obsessed.
And daddy issues.
Yes, daddy issues. She finds something familiar in Ip Man.
So the daddy issues and the mommy issues and everything else about family ties everything together. Wow.
I hate the word daddy issues.
That's just heavy.
But, I mean, it's a simple way to conclude, you know, the whole why does Gonger like Ip Man? Why is her relationship like this? Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, sometimes, like, in a lot of parts of the film, I think also, like, I wish it was faster. Because, like, there would be just one scene of just shots of the environment for like 5 minutes.
It's such a Wong thing. He'd be showing like different sides of a fucking waterfall for like 7 straight minutes. No dialogue, no nothing. It's just the waterfall.
I mean, I like that, but also sometimes I feel like he does it too much.
Like so I don't know long. What the purpose is,
like,
but you
I
know.
I would endure it for 3 minutes, but 5 to 7 minutes is too long.
He does that a lot.
For, you know, for future reference.
Wong, if you're listening.
For criticism. Criticism purposes, because I do love your aesthetic and I love your style. And I would love to watch more of your films without spending 6 hours trying to watch it, especially with the ADHD kicking in.
But yeah, I feel like now that we've already covered like every single character, we can move on to the
Yeah, let's
ending.
Talk about the ending.
Yeah.
I think the ending is a good closure to the characters. I mean, like, it fully concludes Gong Er's story arc, I guess. Like, because in the end, like, she is satisfied with how her life ends, mm-hmm. despite not being in a relationship with Ip Man.
Because
in the end, she's doing what she loves, and mm-hmm. that's Kung Fu.
Mm.
And trying to connect with her dad in that way, and that makes her happy. Like, I guess it does fulfill her in some way. Despite her being depressed because of the heartbreak. With Ip Man, I feel like even though he's not with his family and he didn't see his wife anymore, I guess he kind of had enough experience, especially outside of just his family, into finding what the meaning of life is.
Mm.
Like Gong Er kind of gave that to him in a way.
I'm a sucker for drama. So what I have to say about the ending is that, first of all, I think that it was a perfect ending.
Mm-hmm.
Because every single character arc was finished. There was a satisfying conclusion to everything. But also at the same time, notice how every single character has a tragic end. Tragic doesn't mean like, oh shit, like they lose or they like die in the end or they lose their mind. Tragic in a sense that they, each and every character, lost so much of what they loved.
But isn't that what is realistic though?
Which is why I love it.
What's great about this Wong Kar-wai perspective of this film, because he kind of humanized like every single person that are usually glorified in like a lot of kung fu or martial arts film, that we don't really get to see a side of like have them going through loss and grief and like tragedies, which as is what we usually experience in our daily lives, especially.
Which is what makes it so relatable and so amazing.
Which makes it more realistic and more relatable, like you said, relatable for us, especially as audience who, and especially to me too, since I don't watch a lot of martial arts films, but I'm glad I watched this, you know.
It just, it gives off a very bittersweet feeling to the ending. Like, Gong Er, even though she did get back the Gong family legacy from Ma San, she ended up taking a vow that wouldn't allow her to be together with Ip Man. Because think about it, if she didn't take that vow, she could end up with him.
She could, but also I think it kind of gives like this bittersweet feeling, I guess, of like, in one way, fulfilling your destiny and like what you're made for, especially within the Chinese, the confines of Chinese culture.
I feel like there isn't 100% like satisfaction from any of these characters
for
when
sure.
their arc ended.
But
Gong Er still had so much sorrow, so
like,
much sadness in
but
her.
But like they definitely like fulfilled that
a certain aspect of their life
Chinese,
that they
the
considered
Chinese culture,
most important.
Like what their parents valued and especially these characters valued.
Because
when you think about it, like Chinese culture is about valuing family, valuing your family name, and like upholding the status as like, and all that. You know, you get that gist. But like, these characters in a way fulfill those paths at the cost of their own happiness.
Yeah. Which is what, I just, like I said, I'm a sucker for drama. I love this kind of tragic shit. This kind of tragic ending is also what sort of like, it's like, it brings together like the whole big like Chinese theme that a lot of Chinese movies have. It's basically about like karmic retribution, karma, and like what the universe has in store for you and all that shit.
For sure.
The whole idea is like you reap what you sow. And I'm gonna say, I say you reap what you sow because, like I said, even though they did fulfill a lot of these expectations they had from either their family, blah, 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 or what they feel like the people around them would want coming from them, Gong Er, even though she did get back the family legacy, she ended up, like, even though technically it's not a smart move, she was just very prideful, like, she was just spiteful. She's like, watch me, bitch, that kind of vibe. She also ended up, like, succumbing to opium addiction because of the pain that was caused by the fight she had with Ma San. Ma San, in the end, after, you know, collaborating with the Japanese and then, quote-unquote, sort of like having the Gong family legacy in his hands, ended up having it taken away from Gong Er using the same goddamn like supreme technique that Gong Yutian refused to teach him, sort of like a wake-up call. So in the end, he also lost a lot of things. Ip Man, in his strive for greatness or whatever, or just, you know, just being so kung fu obsessed, he ended up losing his family. He didn't get to see his wife ever again in the end, didn't get to see his kids, and he ended up alone in Hong Kong, even though I bet there was a certain aspect of him who probably figured that maybe I would have a shot with, like, Gong Er, but no, he just ended up alone. Everyone meets a tragic end because, again, you reap what you sow. Every single action you have in this world.
Yeah, and when you think about it, I think it's also a big Wong Kar-wai criticism to Chinese culture.
Oh, really? Why would you say that?
Because, like, I feel like Wong Kar-wai is a pretty open-minded guy, especially since he's made, like, a gay film too.
Yeah.
Yeah, because like, I feel like in a way he's trying to like show this Chinese legacy and culture that a lot of tradition and values that a lot of Chinese people have or uphold. But at the same time, he's showing this aspect of them fulfilling those paths, but at the same time risking their own happiness in the process.
In the at the end of the day, like,
it's kind of showing that when you think about it.
Yeah. What I'm trying to say, it's like, at the end of the day, I wouldn't say that each character had a happy end, but it's sort of like a happy end.
I would say it's bittersweet.
It's bittersweet, yeah.
Because on one hand, they did fulfill those tradition and values that they really, really, really do uphold and they really live by. But at the same time, they have this pride that they cannot say that they're not happy.
It's that sense of responsibility. Like that sense of like you sow.
Yeah, it's kind of like if I choose to, you know, not be out in a way, and I choose to go with like business dream, what my parents want,
yeah,
and continue my dad's company and all that. Like I would be happy because I have fulfilled what I was destined for in a way. That
destined for according to your parents.
Like why they gave birth to me.
Mm.
But at the same time I wouldn't be happy because that's not who I am. Because now I'm in art and like I'm not heterosexual and I'm definitely not like cisgender. Mm-hmm. I'm just non-conforming. But like yeah, that's when you think about it, like you're risking and losing all these things that you could have because you're upholding these values.
But at the end of the day, it's still a path that they chose.
Exactly, which is what I'm saying. That's why it's bittersweet. Mm. Because it did fulfill their character arc in a way, because these characters are very traditional characters that really, really love these values.
There is no, and they lived happily ever after.
So in my mind, it is still them living happily ever after because they fulfilled these things, you know. Even though, like, they're not happy, mm-hmm. but they've made the choices and the decisions. You get what I mean?
No one forced them to take those steps.
Yeah, and they made these decisions themselves.
On their own, yeah. And the universe has a way to, you know, give you what you deserve.
They would probably have a happier afterlife, I guess.
I don't think they're bad people necessarily. I just feel like, you know, I think they'd get reincarnated as another human at the very least,
if
instead of like an ant.
Yeah.
You know, in, you know, the Buddhist tradition. I mean, religion or whatever. But yeah, I mean, It was a great ending to the movie. I think it was great. And even though Amanda took like 6 hours to finish the movie.
Yeah, I would not rewatch it.
Ow, sure. Amanda! Oh, I've watched it 10 times.
I would not rewatch it because I feel like once is enough for me. I don't think I could spend another half day trying to watch the film again.
I get why, because the conversations are very heavy. Chinese people just love this kind of poetic, philosophical shit.
I
mean,
I do too, but I feel like I just don't connect with it in a deeper level like you did.
Yeah, I think it's mainly because, like, I was raised in a much more traditional Chinese household where my parents, like, you know, spoke in Mandarin to me up until I was, like, 6 years old, even though I don't, my Mandarin is really shabby. But at least when people speak it, I understand. It's like, I can relate to all these, like, Chinese philosophical shit because my parents are, like...
I'm not saying it's a bad film.
Yeah.
I'm saying it's a good film, but I wouldn't rewatch it because I think you have a deeper connection with these characters than I do. Like, kind of like me with Bly Manor. Like, I would rewatch the shit out of The Haunting of Bly Manor. I would rewatch the shit out of Imagine Me and You or Saving Face because I connect with the characters and I connect with the story arc and the... how the values and like the themes that are in the films.
But overall, is it a good movie?
It's a good movie.
It's great.
I would give it
like a great movie.
I would give it like 7.5.
10 out of 10 from me.
7.5. because I just think it's kind of a bit slow.
It is. I have to admit, it's like really slow, but I eat up that kind of slow build type of shit.
You know? I like slow so much too, drama, but I think this is like really, really slow.
Compare it to The Irishman.
Okay, The Irishman was also slow, but I don't like The Irishman.
The Irishman was like 3 fucking hours. This Dude, is like
But I don't like The 2 Irishman. Hours.
That is such a shame, Amanda.
I'm sorry, but it's a really good movie. It's just not my thing. Despite me loving slow films, my kind of slow films are very different, I guess.
What would it be like?
Like Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
To me, that's not slow.
It's slow, but I guess not this slow.
Yeah. Slow to like, me is like The Irishman.
Because I feel like with Portrait of a Lady on Fire, even though it's slow, but it doesn't linger too long. Mm. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, because with Wong Kar-wai, he likes his visuals, and he likes to like put light into like the environment and the surroundings and the atmosphere and build it up before putting the characters in.
Yeah, I get that.
But with like Portrait of a Lady on Fire, it's like, okay, it's slow, but also there's this tension and this conversation going on already without just the visuals of the surrounding. Just the plain visuals. Like, there's no that. It's more like there's some of the characters within the shots.
You're right. Yeah, yeah. Portrait of Lady on Fire did not have any, like, scenes that were specifically shown to, like, show off that, yeah, this is a pretty movie, even though it is a pretty movie.
Because I feel like, with me, I love, like, character-based films, like I said, with, like, The Haunting of Bly Manor and all that. Like,
so I'm really surprised that you didn't like The Grandmaster, because it is very character-based.
It is character-based, but it's also very slow.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, the problem with me, especially with the ADHD.
Is that you just, you need a movie that will keep you hooked, like, throughout.
Yeah,
because
it's pretty hard to, like,
I get that, yeah. Because with The Grandmaster, because every single conversation is, like, a metaphor or, like, philosophical shit. You really need to pay attention.
I like those stuff. Like, I talk a lot about, like, grief and all that, and I'm actually working on an art installation / performance art that is based on, like, talking about the thin line between life and death and grief and grieving yourself. And I'm actually talking a lot about, like, philosophical shit. But I think this film is just not for me, personally. Like, it's just not for me.
But I'm surprised you gave it a 7.5. I consider that a win. 7.5 is a pretty high rating.
Because I like the visuals. And I know Wong Kar-wai is a great director.
The visuals are amazing. Y'all.
But then again, I didn't finish In the Mood for Love.
I can see why. Like, when you told me that you didn't finish In the Mood for Love, that's when I was like, okay, Wong's just not Amanda's type
like,
of thing.
Like, I tried. I really tried. And I'm saying this because I love how it started, and I love the themes, and I love the characters, and I love what he does with the film, but somehow, it's just, I couldn't finish it.
Mm. Yeah. Man. 10 out of 10 from me. It is my all-time favorite movie, and I am very honored to have a platform to, like, talk a shit ton about it, because I was so excited to talk about this movie, y'all. I didn't know if I was gonna talk about it, like, in December, or in another month, where we had a specific like theme for Chinese movies or whatever, but I'm so glad that I talked about it in the beginning of December.
I don't think we need a theme for Chinese movies, because I feel like we've been watching a lot of Chinese movies. You've literally been just putting out Chinese movies.
Oh yeah! Oh shit, you're right. Yeah, I watch too many Chinese movies.
We could definitely just like mix it up, because like I watch a lot of Western, and like keep this up so that like I can watch more Chinese movies and you can watch more Western movies.
Yeah.
Which is a good, you know, good balance.
It's a great balance. But yeah, again, as always, we really recommend you to watch Wong Kar-wai's The Grandmaster. It's a great movie for all of you martial arts lovers out there. It's going to be a fucking blast for those who love drama. It's also a fucking blast. Like, so glad we started this month with The Grandmaster. But I feel like we are running out of time. We've been talking so much about this movie. And next week is going to be Amanda's choice. So what winter movie will you make me watch?
I don't know if they have winter in it, but hopefully I want to watch The Handmaiden. But I'm not sure if they have winter in.
That's another Asian movie. But yeah, it's tentative because we need to rewatch the movie and see if they have any winter scenes in it, because the Grandmaster had quite a lot of winter scenes, and they're immaculate, by the way. They're spectacular.
Okay, I think we can watch it just because I feel like they are, some parts of it are in winter.
Yeah. As long as it has winter, it still fits in the December.
Because, like, I don't think necessarily a lot of Asian like countries have a lot of snow.
Yeah, you're right,
So our winter is usually, like, rain or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think next week would be The Handmaiden, and we're also going to do a short podcast on new films. We're starting a new series, because we want to attract more viewers.
Honestly, let's just be honest.
We're being honest, but also we want to attract audience that are seeing new films and want an insight to new films that they've watched, because a lot of people want to talk about it, but they don't know, or they want to hear about analysis of these films.
Yeah.
So we're going to start off that series with Happiest Season.
Ooh, which is so exciting.
A lesbian rom-com.
Of course.
With Kristen Stewart, Mackenzie Davis, and Aubrey Plaza.
Oh my God, I love Aubrey Plaza. I am excited, guys.
Aubrey Plaza looks so good.
But yeah, thank you so much for tuning in to this week's episode.
We'll see you guys next week with two episodes.
Ooh. We're so busy.